I'm Austin Lugo.
I'm Andrew Harp.
This is With Nothing to Say.
Let's talk about Forever a Woman.
Before we get into this week's film, next week we're going to be talking about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. This is one of my favorite films of all times. We have done one Mike Nichols film before, The Graduate, arguably one of his most famous films and still pretty early in his career, certainly early in Dustin Hoffman's career, but Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was sort of a Academy, I don't know, baby almost. I mean, they love it. It was the only one of the only films where all four actors won Best Actor, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress for, of course, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and I don't remember the supporting actor and actress.
George Segal and Sandy Dennis.
That's right. It's, of course, based off the play. The interesting thing about Mike Nichols is he originally comes sort of from the world of plays and Broadway and that sort of thing, and he brought that into film. And
yeah, he's like a comedy guy, and then a play guy, and then a movie guy.
He does it all. I love Mike Nichols. Whenever I watch a Mike Nichols film, I always fall in love with his work. And Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was one of the earliest of his films I saw. And again, kind of like movies we've talked about in the past, it's one of those films that I first saw when I was at film school, and the films I saw during that time kind of have a special effect on me for whatever reason. They just sort of hit at the right moment at the right time. And so now whenever I watch them, I kind of have that sort of nostalgia of this place that I was at and these experiences that I was having when I first saw them. So it's been a minute since I've seen it, about 3 years, and you've never seen it before. Have you
never
seen
seen
any
it.
Mike Nichols films
No.
other than The Graduate?
I've seen The Birdcage, which is fun.
Birdcage, okay. Yeah, that's
not
fun.
Really a, not really a director I find myself gravitating toward. I'll eventually complete his film catalog probably soon enough.
All right. And so today we are talking about our first woman director of 2024. It's been a minute since we've had a female director. And honestly, I was looking at what 2024 has looked at, and it's been very English dominant this year. I don't know, for whatever reason, we've been watching a lot of films in English, a lot of American films. So it was nice to get a bit of a break from American English films. And in an attempt to not watch this before today, which I'm very proud of myself, I didn't watch it this morning. Probably the first time I haven't watched the film right before we recorded in a couple of weeks, which is good because, you know, it is quite early here since I am moving my in-laws out of my house today. So that's very exciting, but I had to get up early so we could do that. So I actually broke this up into two parts, and I didn't do this intentionally, but I think I perfectly broke up Forever Woman into really the two parts of the film, where you have the first era film, which is everything before she gets sick, everything up to the point that she's diagnosed with.
Well, she's sick. But yeah, it's but yeah. Yeah, before a diagnosis, yeah.
But I feel like
Yeah.
There's definitely a different tone once
Yeah.
she gets diagnosed and she's at the hospital, or I don't know if it's necessarily a hospital. It's hospital
like a
esque.
Hospice.
Hospice, yeah, I guess it is hospice. Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. The hospital reminds me of the hospital that they go to in Cure. That he takes his wife to.
Yeah.
It kind of has like this like sort of like outdoor quality to it. Like the hallways are like outdoors, right? They have it's very odd. I don't know if like hospitals or like medical facilities are all like this in Japan. I don't know, but it reminded me of that.
Yeah, I got a lot of Kurosawa vibes. Maybe sort of 1950s Kurosawa vibes from this. I mean, of course, it's of the same
from the
era.
movie.
Yeah, it just.
Oh, I mean, like I've never seen it. I've seen Ozu films, but obviously none of the big ones. I mean, even I could see that, like, you know, it was very Ozu-esque.
Oh yeah.
It in a lot of different ways. You know, low camera angles, the way the actors kind of like speak at the camera sometimes, but not really looking directly at it. You know, they're kind of like almost sort of looking at it, sort of. That I believe if I'm not mistaken, is very Ozu-esque.
It is.
And yeah, you know, it's a story about like family and existentialism, you know, like what am I doing, you know, like that kind of thing. I understand that that is also Ozu-esque. And you know, it's you know, it's a movie that of course is directed by a very famous Japanese actor, Kenio Tanaka. And I believe that it's based off a book and that the screenplay is written by a woman as well. And I would say that the movie is, you know, it's a very, it's a very, I think what you get, especially for its time in 1955, a very progressive, feministic film, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and when we talk about Ozu, as someone who fell in love with Ozu a while ago and is very familiar with his work, I would say I'm near completionist when it comes to Ozu. I've seen almost every film that he's made. There is a lot of inspiration from him and a lot of the Japanese filmmakers of the time. Of course, this is a very specific era of Japanese filmmaking. This is post-World War II, so there's this
right after.
Very, it's almost with, you know, every single film I've seen, Japanese film I've seen of this era, has this certain darkness behind it and trying to
it's
grasp with
sad.
This sort of this new world order that we're living in, and also
it's devastating,
extremely devastating, and also just sort of like the past and the future kind of coming together. I mean, this film opens on her literally riding in on a wagon, like, drawn by donkeys.
She lives out in the country, yeah.
And you know, by the middle of the film, there's cars and there's businessmen, there's all these things, and it's this weird moment in Japanese history where sort of like the ancient past, because really up until like the mid 1800s, they were isolationists and they kind of lived in their own existence and had persisted in this ancient tradition, and then suddenly they get all this modernity in a very short amount of time. And you see this in a lot of Ozu's work, and this is something Ozu plays a lot with in his work, is how do we face the traditions that we have built for hundreds, if not thousands of years? How do we equate that with sort of this extremely fast-paced moving modernity and sort of the older generation versus the younger generation, and these different things that are happening simultaneously, and trying to meet somewhere in the middle, trying to meld these things together in all the ways that it can work, and all the ways that at the time they're really struggling to put these two things together, because you want to keep your traditions holy, you want to keep these things that you have had forever, but also you don't want to be locked in the past. And I think you see that in this piece too, is sort of facing these different things simultaneously. And we talk about the idea of a very feminist piece and progressive in some of its outlook. And I think a lot of that has to do with the perspective that we're taking here. I mean, we have the perspective of a woman who at the beginning of the piece is first and foremost a mother. She's a caretaker, and she's doing her best. She's trying to take care of her husband, but her husband is he?
Yeah, her husband's an asshole.
He is an asshole. But is he like addicted to opioids? Or
I think yeah, he's taking drugs, he's drinking, he doesn't have a job, he's kind of like self-loathing, and then he sleeps with another woman. And this happens like in the first 10 minutes of the movie or something like that.
And the lack of shame that he has for
he doesn't show any remorse.
No remorse at all. Really, at any point in this film, I mean, she's just trying to do her best. She's trying to care for him and be a good wife and a mother, and he just doesn't give a shit. I mean, when that scene where she comes back to the house that's after the first poetry meeting, right? That she goes back to the house. Or is that before the first poetry meeting?
I don't really know.
I don't remember. Because I remember the reason she goes back to the house is someone tells her that there's another woman there. I can't remember.
Right, yeah.
But someone tells her that there's another woman there. So she's like, oh, that's weird. But she doesn't. She has.
I think
a
someone
certain
says like
naivety.
Not another woman, but like a visitor. I think
A
is what they
visitor,
say, right?
right?
Yeah.
You had a visitor, and there's kind of something a little suspicious about it. But I think
Yeah.
in her naivete, she's trying not to think much of it, and it's very obvious that he does very
Yeah,
little to
yeah.
hide the fact that he was at that moment. Right? She was gone for like an hour, and he immediately sleeps with
Yeah,
someone
yeah.
else.
Right.
And she is rightfully devastated by it. And I love that scene when it's almost absurd, her trying to, like, the lover, the mistress, whatever you want to call her, tries to hide away. And, you know, the classic, like, her back's turned and she,
Yeah.
you know, almost comedic in its absurdity. And in that moment where she walks outside and she sees that woman running away, and it very obviously, like, it's obviously her, right? It's
Right,
obviously
yeah. She's like, she's sprinting.
Because there's a woman running away, and
Right,
there's not really anyone else around. But
yeah.
I think it makes a good balance of both being a little absurd, and yet it feels very real. I think one of the reasons I think this moment is so powerful, and so many moments in this film are so powerful, is it's not like it indulges in the pain. Instead, it feels very realistic. It feels as if this is what would actually happen if you walked in on your husband cheating on you, right? It feels like these are the things that we do. It doesn't try to sort of dramatize this moment. Rather, it leans into, like, here's actually what would happen if you walked in while your husband was sleeping with another woman. And here's exactly kind of the way they would go about it. And it's tough. And then immediately, within like 20 minutes, she's a divorced woman.
Right. And he's like, in his character, like he kind of like is he sort of like keeps like saying to her like about the fact that the relationship is over, essentially. But she isn't like listening. Like he's just kind of like, yep, it's over, it's done with, you know, like he's sort of like given up, right? Although she has not given up. And then, you know, she does, she gets divorced. And then you pretty much never see him again, for the most part. And, you know, so yeah, she has to take care of the kids now, and she has to, like, you know, have her, like, her family help her out and stuff like that. And, you know, I think the most important part of the movie is the fact that, like, she is like a talented poet.
Yes.
And she's like going to these like poetry meetings, you know, hanging out with them and talking to them. And, you know, that's a big part of the movie. Of course, like, the reason why she goes to these poetry meetings, as she reveals, kind of, you know, about halfway through the movie, is that like a childhood friend of hers that she is in love with, goes to them.
And maybe this is just because this is the last movie on a poet that we saw, but I can't help thinking of, and I can't remember the name of the film. What was that Indian film that we watched about that? It was like a super famous poet in India. Do you remember the name of that film?
A super famous poet in India.
Yeah, it was an Indian film. He's like the Orson Welles of
Oh,
India.
Pyaasa.
Yeah, Pyaasa.
Yeah.
It was the
That's
first
a good
film
movie.
I thought of, although I couldn't think of the name of
Oh,
it.
yeah.
You know
Like
what I
the
mean?
kind of like,
Yeah.
yeah, like the down in the dumps, like, yeah, like poet who is like really talented and is trying to like, that's actually like a pretty good like movie to compare to, I would say. Yeah, like kind of like, yeah, that's a really good example, I would say, of like kind of like a comparison, because as we go to the movie, she quickly becomes famous for her poetry, sort of, you know, because and again, like, she's only going to the poetry meetings, as she reveals, to be with this guy, right, who is taken, by the way. He has like a wife. So she's only writing poetry and things like that just so she can go to these poetry meetings to be near him. But she's really good at it, and so she kind of like finds herself sort of like fallen into like this club, and then she kind of follows into being famous and all this stuff. But of course, the whole movie pretty much is sort of unfortunate. There's unfortunate turns constantly.
Yeah, one of the things that I find really interesting about this piece is this view on pain and suffering and the way in which it sort of informs our art and how it shapes our art and sort of how it's almost necessary to create great art. Because remember at the beginning of the piece when they talk about her work when she's, I wouldn't say necessarily happily married, but...
Yeah. They're like talking about like, yeah, keep going, sorry.
She is happy enough in her marriage. She at least is deluding herself in the idea that she's happy, even though her husband, from the very beginning, it's very clear that he doesn't have these same feelings towards her. But when they talk about her poetry near the beginning, they talk about how it's kind of dull and uninteresting. And I think it's really interesting, too, that the person who is always commenting on her poetry at the poetry meetings is another woman. She's always the one sort of saying,
who's
kind of pushing her down,
yeah.
Right? It's never
the
other men that are
right.
commenting on her
poetry. I feel like women, you know, quote unquote women, you know what I mean? Like can probably, because I'm not a woman, can relate to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like kind of like this sort of like competition, right, within genders.
Mm-hmm. And this is sort of tenfold in an era and also a country
right.
that had very specific roles for masculinity and femininity. Mm-hmm. And so sort of climbing up that ladder, it makes sense why you see this, right, in every culture and every community, where if there's only a few people who can be near the top and it's very hard to get there, of course you're going to push everyone else down because
right.
You know, there's only enough room for one of you, or
yeah.
only enough room for a few of you. And that's exactly what we're saying here, is that woman, you know, who is the better poet, quote unquote, at the beginning,
yeah.
is insulting her work because she's in that place right now. And she knows that, you know, there's only enough room there for a few women. I mean, you look at that poetry circle and it is mostly men. I mean, there are a couple of women, but if she doesn't do it right, she's afraid that her spot is going to be taken. There's not enough room at the
yeah.
top for all of them. So there has to be this sort of dark, competitive environment, which we see throughout the piece. And the irony, of course, is that our protagonist here, she doesn't
give a fuck.
She doesn't.
Yeah. She doesn't really care about like becoming famous or anything like that.
No.
And the only person that's encouraging her to like publish her poems to like a newspaper or whatever is the guy,
mm-hmm.
her friend, who, you know, spoilers, he dies. He dies horribly out of nowhere. Just really like they have a meeting. They like talk for a minute, I think, about her poems.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next scene, he dies. And then the next scene, they go to his funeral. Which, by the way, I was one of the funny things about the movie that I thought was kind of interesting was the presence of like Christianity in it. Because like they're talking about like prayers a lot. And when he dies, you know, they're in a Christian church, like the funeral is. And the wife of the guy who dies, like talks about like praying and stuff like that too. It's weird. I've never like, I don't know if I've ever seen like, I don't know. It seems particularly old. It's a Japanese film that's old that has like Christian stuff in it. That seems kind of unusual to me.
Yeah, I guess I didn't think too long on that, but you make a good point there. There's definitely this sense of prayer in this piece, and fate too. I think fate plays a big part in this piece, and the things that we can change and the things that we can't. Of course, there's that famous Christian prayer, right? You know, help me with the things that can change and those that can't, you know, whatever it is, and, you know, give me the strength to know the difference. However that goes, I know I butchered that. But that is sort of one of the big themes here, and something that our protagonist here has to come to terms with is there's no reason she gets breast cancer. I mean, there's no justice here. There's no karma sort of going on, that, oh, you got breast cancer because you did this,
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
that, that
yeah.
thing, right? She's nothing but a genuinely good
It's
character, and
arbitrary.
it's completely arbitrary. And yet, even though she can't do anything about it, and at first, of course, she's horrified by it, and her identity as a woman is connected with her body itself, which makes sense
Right.
because she has been taught and put in a society in which a woman isn't valued for what they think or what they say, but merely for how they look. So when she loses that beauty, quote unquote, she suddenly is no longer a woman. She doesn't see herself as a woman. She has that great conversation with the reporter. And when she's at hospice and they're behind the bars, and you see this a lot, this is one of the things, one of the visual themes of this film is
Oh,
they're
yeah,
almost
those bars and
constantly
the
talking
windows,
behind bars, right? It's as if
yeah.
they're imprisoned by their own ideas of how the world works. And then it's constantly frames within frames. We never get that kind of big, large, whole frame. There's always something in the way, always something in
Yeah.
front of them, something trapping them.
She's always
And,
like, yeah, she's like tortured by like like how the world works, right? Like the traditional family structure sort of I mean, that's what gave her cancer, right? Like that was the thing that gave her cancer. And it's ironic too, right? Like the breast, which is like, you know, men can get it too, of course, but like I think like it is a very high rate. It's a relatively high rate in women, right? So it's kind of like this thing that like is sort of like eating away at her, right? Being a woman or whatever. And actually, on Criterion, the movie is called Forever a Woman. That's the title of it. But another title for it that I found is The Eternal Breasts,
Really?
which I like. Yeah.
That's huh. But yeah, that's interesting because, of course, the breast is kind of this idea of, we think of breastfeeding, and that's sort of giving
Yeah.
it's producing life, and sort of it's the connection between sort of, right, like when a baby's produced, first they're sort of inside, and then once they're outside of you, it's that connection still to that person, that human. And so when you lose that, and of course, another big theme of this film is sort of that relationship that she has with her children, and the how she sh struggles to connect with them. Because early on in the film, and maybe I missed this, I didn't really understand why she keeps her daughter, but her son goes with her husband. I don't know
I don't know.
why. Okay.
It's just a. It's. I
This
think it's
is
just
what
kind of like
happens.
a. No, I think. Yeah, I guess it's just kind of like a. The agreement that they made, I guess. I don't
Okay.
know. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, and there's that wonderful moment. I love this moment where she's at the park playing with her daughter, and
Yeah.
she sees her ex-husband and
His new wife.
his new wife and his son,
Good boy.
and she sort of like runs to the side of the park, and she pretends to push her daughter, and she's kind of like almost feverishly looking back, and she's terrified to be seen or noticed. And then there's that moment too later on when she's at hospice and she leaves hospice a couple of times to go do things. And of course, she's like, they like wag their finger at her, which is a
Like, don't
ridiculous
do
thing
that.
to do. Like, they're like, oh, well, you're going to get worse. It's like she's dying. Who cares what she does? Why does it
Yeah,
matter
it's like,
where she goes? But she goes to the school, and her son drops a ball, and it kind of like rolls into the distance, and she's hiding behind some
Yeah, she's spying on him.
structure. She's spying on him, and she throws the ball back in,
Yeah.
and there's this very large sense of yearning, almost, to this connection to her children that she can't seem to get back. It's not only that she can't wholly connect with her son, but even her own daughter, there's this distance that is created that she never feels like she can get back. And I think of that
Yeah,
drawing
like these
too.
kids, they're both kids are kind of like at that age where like they're kind of like they don't really like get it, but they can still like walk around and talk and stuff, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the boy's like 5 or 6 years old, and the girl's like 2 or 3. And it's a really strange age, and I think it's the perfect age to make the children in this film, because they are in this place in life where they are conscious, they're speaking, they're thinking, but they don't yet really have the cognitive ability to grasp the situation. And like, from a certain perspective, they understand that their mother is sick, quote unquote, but they can't grasp the reality that, like, what it means to die, like what death is in general. And of course, that's sort of the thing that our protagonist is terrified of. I mean, we see that great scene where her roommate dies, and she follows her to the morgue, which for some reason giant metal bars, like a prison cell.
It's just kind of like the gate, you know, the door or whatever that they lock it to. Yeah, that scene is very dreamlike.
Yeah.
Something very dreamlike about it.
Mm-hmm. Just with the like soft lighting and the way they film it, and you know, there's almost always a wind going somewhere. Yeah. And the moment's almost nightmarish, because in a sense she's seeing her own future, and at that point she's still terrified of her own death. And the reporter, you know, when he first comes to her, of course, the article you written, he's like, oh, well, she's basically dead. Like, it's over. And and I think her anger doesn't necessarily come from a place of, you know, you're wrong, how dare you say this? The anger more comes from a place of that she believes that herself, or she has already accepted that she's basically already dead, and there's no point to being alive. And in this reason, I was thinking of a Kurosawa film. I was specifically thinking of Ikiru, right? Once he's diagnosed with cancer too, right? He suddenly has this urge to sort of push for something, right? He spends his whole life in this government position that is kind of meaningless. And suddenly when death is upon him, he suddenly has the urge to do something with his life, right? Because it is so short. And we see this with her too, is once she realizes that she cannot change, right? She can't change the fact that she has breast cancer, that it's gone to her bones, that she is going to die. She's in hospice.
She's like, fuck it. Like, she kind of and you know, there's that one scene too, where she's like taking a bath in the lady's house. Right. And so she kind of starts talking a little and acting a little differently, because she's like, doesn't care. Like, she talks even more honestly than she was before, where she's talking about like, yeah, I was in love with your husband, and, you know, da 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 da, and like, you know, look at me, you know, like, look at my, I don't really care if you see me naked, like, who cares, you know, like, she's completely she has no shame really anymore, for the most part. I think also, like, she gets mad at the newspaper reporter because she still kind of has like a sense of dignity. And so people like writing and being like, yep, she's going to die soon, is kind of like not a very like dignified thing to have happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, she's still, again, you know, she has much less shame than she did before. And, you know, conceptions of like, you know, nudity and honesty and all this stuff doesn't really matter. Although it comes out earlier, like, I love that part where like she's talking to her mom, and the mom is like, oh, you know, like, you should have done this or that with your ex-husband, and she's like, well, I never wanted to marry him anyway, like, you pushed me to marry him. And then the mom ignores the question. You know, like, that's another good kind of like moment to kind of like shows her kind of like pushing against the main character, kind of like pushing against like the culture's status quo, in favor of, you know, more honesty, more and, you know, with more honesty, you know, you can have like more beauty, you can have like more beautiful art, I think. But yeah, like, the mother just completely ignores her question, her what she said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at that moment where she's taking the bath, and her brother and the wife of the best friend that she was in love with, and someone else, they're all in the room and they're talking. And the brother expresses his concern how she has become almost childlike. And it's interesting, you sort of look at the character arc of our protagonist here, and she goes from sort of this person who is responsible for everything. I mean, has to do everything.
Like
has
a
to do everything
matriarch.
for, yeah, from like the matriarch. And over the course of the film, she sort of has this reversal into almost letting go
she's
of
like
that responsibility
yeah
and
she's
becoming
kind
a
of like
child, really.
infantilized, yeah.
And she becomes the thing that she was taken care of, and it also reflects us as humans, right, in our long lives, where, you know, as children our parents take care of us, and then as we get older we take care of our parents. And then, of course, as we get old, right, we become childlike again. I mean, Emily often talks about she's moving to work in schools next year, so she's going to be working with much younger people than she works with now. But she talks about, you know, all the similarities when we, you know, talk about our days at the end of the day, how similar sort of, you know, people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, right? That population is almost a mere reflection of sort of the elementary school kids and middle school kids and high school kids, and how in the circle of life we kind of end and start in the same place. And we see her sort of letting go of that responsibilities, but it's not in a way, at least in this piece, where it doesn't feel selfish, right? It's not like she's doing this because, like, oh, she just doesn't care about her kids anymore, she doesn't care about her family anymore. It's more kind of as you were saying, right, she's let go of that self-consciousness. It's almost stoic in that she has let go of this need to be desired and to sort of prove herself, right? I am worthy. She no longer feels this need, and that's a very powerful thing. And I think that's where the power of her poems comes from. And I think that's one of the big arguments here, is where the power of great art comes from, is we have to let go, which is strange. And David Foster Wallace talks about this a lot, and it's actually one of the pieces that I read with my students towards the beginning of the year. This idea where we first produce art for ourselves, but then once we produce art for ourselves, like, we become famous, and so then we want to produce art for other people. We want to, you know, we want that pride, want that dignity, which we kind of see in the middle of the film here, right? She is insulted when you know, someone talks about her dying, or, you know, any criticism of her work in this middle point, and then once she can let go of that, once she can let go of other people's judgments of her work, that's when you produce your best work, is when you're once again writing for yourself and not someone else. And that's why you kind of have those, right? I mean, she asks him to throw all of her poems into the lake, right? She's not writing these poems for anyone else. I mean, the reason those early poems didn't work at all, beyond the fact that perhaps there wasn't the pain and suffering, but she was writing them to impress, right, the poetry group, but particularly to impress the man she was truly in love with. She wasn't really writing them for herself. It wasn't until she was writing them, of course, perhaps one of the most famous examples of this is Kafka himself. We don't have most of his work because he asked that after he passed away, that all of his work be thrown in the fire, which a great majority was. And so part of the reason that we don't have a lot of his work. And we say the same thing here is, you know, as an artist, she wasn't doing it for anyone else, and it didn't matter if anyone ever saw it, because that wasn't the point of the poetry, right? The point wasn't for other people to read it, or other people to be inspired by it, or for her to be famous. She was writing the poetry because she was a poet, right? She was practicing art because she was an artist and nothing else.
Right. And but I will say too, like, along with that though, is that, like, you know, is that she's still, like, lonely. And it doesn't, like, DFW also, like, talk about that, like I think he was asked, like, what's the point of all this shit, or, like, what's the point of, like, making novels or doing this or that. And I think he said something along the lines of, like, you know, I don't really know, but I know it has something to do with, like, loneliness, right? Like, sort of, like, you know, like being, like, crushed by loneliness, and like, you possibly maybe using the power of, you know, film, novels, whatever you want to call it, to somehow, like, connect with other people in a way that talking to them just wouldn't do. It just wouldn't be the same, right? And so, yeah, like, she is, like, she's still like a lonely person, right? Like she wants to be with her friend, her childhood friend. And then, you know, of course the journalist comes in and of course they form, you know, they have an affair, they have a relationship. You know, she doesn't want to be alone, you know? So she's not like a robot who kind of like throws away everything, or like not a robot, but like someone who's just kind of like throwing away everything and like, I don't need any of it. You know, she's still kind of like, she's still like lonely. Like she still wants, like she still has desire, like every human does. Which I like, of course, you know, I like that they have that aspect of her being like, look, like, you know, I'm a person, I'm a woman or whatever, you know, like I need like a companionship, you know, I'm borderline like desperate for it, as most people are. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important aspect too, especially of course, like in the second half of the movie, as she's dying and she's talking to the journalist and stuff.
Yeah. And there's that shame of her lustfulness because.
Right. She's just like, she talks about sinning. Another mm-hmm. Christianity thing. Another
Christian thing. I think of this S. Scott Fitzgerald story that I read a couple of months ago in this collection of short stories called The Jazz Age. And the story is about this circus performer and the stockbroker that fall in love. I think the woman's a circus performer and the guy's a stockbroker. And over the course of the short story, by the end of the short story, he becomes a circus performer and she becomes a stockbroker. And it's a very weird reversal, but it's interesting that at the beginning of the film, she sort of sees the mistress and she, as often happens, right, instead of blaming her husband for his infidelity, the first person she blames is the other woman, quote unquote.
Right.
And yet then later in the film, she herself becomes the other woman. Of course, she doesn't cheat in the same way that perhaps the mistress that she found before, but she had those same feelings and she was acting on those same impulses. And so she becomes the thing that she fears most. And she has this shame of her lust and there's the shame of lustfulness, as if, you know, for a woman to. And of course, this double standard, right, for this woman to be lustful at this point in time, it is shameful, right? A woman should be virginal almost, and
yeah,
both in the fidelity and the way they experience the world. And so her desire for anyone feels very shameful. And I think what's so powerful when she finally decides to have the affair, or, you know, sleeps with, or, you know, makes love to the reporter, is that is the moment where she can finally let go of that sinning of lust. And of course, that's a big thing in Christianity too, right? The idea that, you know, those thoughts are impure, those thoughts are evil. And if you have those kind of thoughts, especially if you're a woman, you should be ashamed, right? The only reason you should be participating in that activity as a woman is because you are producing a child. If you're doing it for any other reason, you're mm-hmm. a whore, right? You're a slut, another million words for it. But it's her ability to overcome that and see it as what it truly is, which is just two people who are in love, mm-hmm. so much more powerful. And that, oh my God, that moment where she's looking in the mirror and she sees him in the reflection, oh God, that is perfect.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing about this movie, right? Like that's kind of like the funny thing about this movie, right? Like if you go on like the Wikipedia page for the movie, it's like really short. It's like very, very short. It's like there's nothing like on it, right? And like and before this movie was put on Criterion, like where was it? Like where could you reliably watch this movie? I don't even think you probably could have bought it like on Amazon to like like to rent or anything like that. Like I don't like, were there any like DVDs? You know, it's like where the heck was this? Cause it's not really like, I don't think it's not a movie that I don't think most people are clamoring to. Like, it's not a super famous movie or anything like that. It's nothing like that, but it still happens to have some of the most beautiful shots like of all time. Like, I love the shot when her son's leaving and she's like looking down in the snowy alley from her window as he's walking away. That's like one of the greatest like shots like ever composed. Like, again, like, it's just crazy, like, you know, Japanese filmmakers, like, during this time, like, they were killing it. Like, they were composing some of the most beautiful images ever.
It's truly just like other level stuff. And it's so crazy because surely you would think this film would have like a very loyal following. I mean, here you have one of the most famous actors of her time, utilizing, you know, in some of the work of some of the most famous directors, you know, Ozu and Kurosawa and all this stuff. And yet, I mean, until
You
very
know,
recently,
I
you can't
guess,
even do
you
it.
know, it's because, you know, she's a woman, right? Like, I don't
Yeah,
know. Like,
it's a big factor.
I think her, I think she was like probably what one of the, I think I read like she was one of the first, like, you know, working Japanese film, women filmmakers, like, ever, right? Like, whoever, like, you know, at this level, at least, you know. So, I mean, you know, it's definitely like setting up, she really kind of like, you know,
She sets the
that's, you
bar
know,
high.
yeah, she did a really good job. And, like, you know, I think what, like, 7 or 8 of her films are available on Criterion, which, you know, Criterion is not like a perfect, like, streaming service or anything like that, but I mean, that's kind of, I'm glad that, you know, that's kind of what it's for, right? To kind of like put up nice HD you know, versions of these kind of forgotten movies, and then we can watch them. And then we realize, wow, like, that's really, really good. And, you know, they have like every Kurosawa and Ozu movie on there too. And I haven't seen all of them, obviously. And there's probably a reason why they're so famous, obviously. But it is nice to kind of watch something that's a little bit more, you know, from, you know, obviously from the perspective of a woman during that time too. You know, I think it adds to that. Even though, like, we're talking a lot about like Kurosawa and Ozu and stuff like that, and obviously those influences are mixed in there, no doubt about it. But I really, again, from the writing and kind of like from the perspective, you know, that perspective, I think is really important.
I'm just blown away by so many visuals in this film, and just so many. I mean, the black and white cinematography here is just
Yeah.
obnoxiously beautiful and delicious, dare I say. I mean, of course, you sort of have the leanings of the Ozu, where low camera angle and often just these very long shots that will just go on for very long. It's almost shot like a play, like a lot of Ozu stuff was. And a lot of filmmakers, Japanese filmmakers of this time, sort of shot in this way. It is sort of almost, I get hearkening back to an earlier time, and it's a very challenging thing to do well. I mean, there's a reason that most films have a shot every 3 seconds, because you want to keep your audience constantly entertaining. You need that constant editing and cutting from this to that to the other thing, and to just hold on these images for long periods of time and trust your actors to sort of be in the place. I mean, we have scenes where you'll go the whole scene where you won't even see the person's face, right? Their back will be to the camera, which typically you don't hold on those shots very long. And it doesn't feel like a mistake here. This isn't something from a naive filmmaker. This is someone who knows what they're doing and does it very well. I mean, the staging just throughout the entire film is just
Yeah.
magnificent. And I think that's where this film really shines. It is, you know, well, the cinematography, I think, itself is beautiful, but I think the cinematography only works in that how the characters move within the mise-en-scène as a
No,
whole.
they're perfectly, I think they're very well composed, like, throughout the entire film, you know. And you know, a movie like this, I think, and I would use this word, not, you know, I hate to use this word to describe, like, Tanaka's, like, filmmaking, because it's like makes me like, it's like a word that's associated with women a lot, right? Like delicate. But I would also describe, like, Ozu's and Kurosawa's filmmaking as delicate as well. It's delicate and composed, and it has like a lot of like dignity, to it. And like you said, like, there's like layers of things going on. And, you know, like, you know, the use of objects and the use of like rooms and stuff feels very, well, you know, it's just like well put together, like you said, where people, you know, are situated and the way that people like flow within and out without scenes. You know, even just like a shot of like a person like laying down or a person like laying down with someone, it's perfectly composed. You know, like I think there's, you know, it proves that like, you know, you can make anything, you can make any kind of image, even if it's just like a person or two people, really beautiful. And so, yeah, again, they're just, you know, again, just filmmakers in this country during this time, they were just like cooking with so much gas. Like, it's just kind of, it's just crazy. Like anytime, like you watch like a Kurosawa, anytime you like put on a Kurosawa from this era that you've never seen, you're just like, oh, that's one of the most beautiful. One of the most beautiful images. Oh, another one, like another beautiful. You know, it's just like it just keeps on going. Or and of course the content as well. It's like, oh, that was the saddest thing ever. Oh, another, you know, another really extremely sad moment. Okay.
It's they just did it different out there. It, oh God, I can think of those final moments. She passes away.
Yeah, that's one of the saddest fucking endings of all time. I was bawling. I cried a lot.
Honestly, I mean, it's legitimately just like so heart-wrenching and painful to watch.
When the friend puts down the like the note of the journalist saying that he was going to come by soon, whew, that is. And I was watching the movie like, this movie's not going to make me cry. It's not make me cry. I do have like my scruples about it. I don't think it's perfect. I do think that like when she's in hospice, there is kind of this feeling of like repetition going on where I kind of felt myself kind of like slipping away from it. When right before the whole movie is like very engaging right up to she gets the diagnosis and then she gets sick and then they're like, you're a famous poet. And then I kind of start to feel myself slipping a little bit where I'm kind of in this zone where I'm just kind of like, I'm almost like, where I'm kind of like losing, like I don't have anything going on. I'm just watching the movie, but I feel myself kind of like losing my attention.
Yeah.
But then at, towards the end, like it, it, you know, gets your attention again. That's probably like my main complaint with the movie is that it might not have the best, like, what's the word? Like the best pacing, in a couple spots. But then, yeah, the ending is just like, it destroys you.
I mean, watching those children, right? They realize that their mother is dead or, you know, have some sort of semblance of what that means, but they don't fully grasp it. And we see her pushed out and into the morgue, of course, reflecting that image of when our protagonist herself, right, walked towards the morgue. Mm-hmm. And the children are locked out, right? They're not allowed like into the morgue, right? They're not allowed that closure of their mother dying of this thing.
They don't even get it.
Yeah.
They're calling after her. They don't know she died.
Yeah. It's God, it's just such,
it's sad.
It's agonizing. It's the saddest
movie ever. It's so sad. Yeah.
All right. Well, should we wrap this up then? I feel like we've reached
we've talked for about an hour. Yeah.
Okay. So this film is, I mean, just spectacular.
It rocks.
I admit I had some big expectations coming in. I mean, here is an era and time, perhaps one of my favorite in filmmaking history. I mean, there's just so many incredible filmmakers that are just killing it in this part of the world that I expected a lot from this, and I was not disappointed at all. I mean, it is just absolutely beautiful, and the staging is just brilliant and incredible performances, which we didn't really talk all that much about, but truly wonderful performances here. The story is heartbreaking, and I mean, you can't help but cry and those final moments, and everything just works so well together that I can't help but give this film a solid 9 out of 10.
I'm gonna go with like an 8 out of 10, I think, for me personally. It's really good. Again, I wouldn't say that it's like perfect all the way through or like pleasurable all the way through. You know, it kind of has like this sort of like pacing problem for me. But again, you know, it's a good, again, it has some unbelievable images, some great, you know, plenty of stuff to part and parcel through in the context of, you know, the cultural moment in Japan at the time that I think is really interesting. A very progressive, great kind of feministic movie that I think is very important to watch if, you know, you're interested in Japanese film or Japanese film of this era. And yeah, I love it. It's great.
All right, y'all. Thank you for listening. You can find everything I do at Austin Lugo.
I'm on Letterboxd.Retro, Andrew, RATR0, Andrew.
And you can find this podcast wherever you hear podcasts. Here's some fans on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at With Nothing to Say. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you.